real effect of this system of government will therefore be brought home to the feelings of the people through the medium of the judicial power. It is moreover of great importance to examine with care the nature and extent of the judicial power, because those who are to be vested with it are to be placed in a situation altogether unprecedented in a free country. They are to be rendered totally independent, both of the people and the legislature, both with respect to their offices and salaries. No errors they may commit can be corrected by any power above them, if any such power there be. Nor can they be removed from office for making ever so many erroneous adjudications. So wrote a pundit who called himself Brutus in the New York Journal, January 31, 1788, reflecting on the power of an independent judiciary branch in the American government. How did the founders of the American Republic go about establishing a judiciary for a democratic country? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What relationship did the first presidents, Washington, Adams, and Jefferson, have with the Supreme Court? And what part did politics play in the selection of judges? And if the judiciary was so independent, what did it take to remove a judge? Our guest is John Kaminsky, the founder and director of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
You know, that phrase, independent judiciary, is still a kind of hot-button phrase today. You hear it argued about. Can you tell us a little bit about why that argument's still with us and how we have to go back in time to understand it?
There's many pressures that are put upon judges when a case comes before them. And the founders of our Constitution, they wrestle with that problem, trying to make the judges immune from these outside pressures. Some of those pressures were from the executive. In the case of England, that meant the king. In the case of the United States, that meant the president. But from the legislature as well, independent from the people, the pressure that's there. And so the way to avoid that kind of pressure is have the judges not be elected by the people, but others want pressure from the people. The press can create certain pressures on the judiciary. Stare decisis is a pressure that's there. That is, previous rulings limit what a judge feels he or she can do. Then there's also the common law, this heritage that we have that goes way back to time immemorial and decisions that have been made in the past. And finally, there's always the appellate courts that are there. And so you'll find that judges are always looking up to the next court. Will they support their decisions or will they reconsider their cases and overturn? They often judges will almost keep score of how many times they've been overturned. You have a low batting average, you're not smiled upon. and so this sense of how independent are you? In England, there was the Court of Last Resort is the House of Lords, where you have a committee of the Lords that is the final court. That's their Supreme Court. And we don't have that in the United States. We have the Supreme Court issues the final decision. And people will object to their interpretation of the law.
So how did the Founding Fathers go about coming up with this balance where it's the kind of thing that Brutus is expressing his concern about, where the court is insulated from these immediate influences and yet not above some kind of balance and check?
Well, they put in different provisions in the Constitution, salary and the term of office for good behavior and any number of other things. But all of these protections that they put into the Constitution were based upon a long history, English history, and then their own colonial history, that they were quite aware of the importance of the independence of the judiciary. And they realized that without an independent judiciary, the rights of individuals could be threatened by either the executive, the monarch, or in the case of England, or colonial governors, or by the legislatures. And so it was an important thing to draw upon this old history that they had. And it's one of the things, really, that separates our Constitution from many other constitutions in third world countries, that we have that constitutional and judicial heritage that others don't have. And that was very important for our founders.
If we're trying to understand the sort of English foundations for the American concept of the judiciary, what's most important for us to know about England?
I would say perhaps it's how the English protected their rights. And there's two ways in particular, I would say, that are very important. The first is, I mentioned briefly, the common law. And the common law is basically composed of all the judicial decisions that were ever made, going back as far as anybody could remember or anybody could record, and then tradition and things of that nature. And then in addition to that, the English will take some of their great historical documents, starting with Magna Carta, but other documents like Petition of Right, the Bill of Rights, the Habeas Corpus Act, things of this nature. And what we see in English history, different from American history, is that the English put in these great documents rights that had been violated. These great documents don't create any rights at all. They just mention the rights that the monarch of the day had been violating. And so that's what Magna Carta did. Magna Carta in 1215 lists over 60 different articles protecting rights that King John had violated. Now, the Americans don't look at all 60 of these. Many of them are archaic, feudalistic rights, and you'd be hard-pressed to understand them today. But there were four things in Magna Carta that the Americans took from that. The first is that government is limited. It's a very important concept. That's sort of an umbrella for Magna Carta. But the other three things, first is that there is no taxation without the approval of one's direct representatives. Second, no one can be deprived of their life, liberty, or property without a trial by jury of their peers according to the law of the land. And then third, the king could not sell or deprive anyone of justice or rights. And so they were there for everyone, justice and right. And that couldn't be slowed down. You couldn't put somebody in jail for a period of time and keep them there. So those four provisions of Magna Carta are tremendously important.
What about the status of judges in England? The way we think now of, you know, judges with their robes, and there's a kind of imperial quality to the judiciary. I'm wondering how much of that comes from English practice.
To a certain extent, yes. But I think what is even more important in English history is the fact that judges were at first under the direct control of the monarchy. And so their actions were dependent upon what the king wanted. And so, as is often the case with judicial decisions, probably 99.99% are fairly common and ordinary, and they don't draw any attention. But it's those rare cases that get a lot of publicity and a lot of attention drawn to them, and that become precedent for major governmental decisions and actions. And so when the judges in old England would go against the king and rule in favor of the rights of an individual, whether that individual be the barons, as in the case of Magna Carta, or in the case of the Somerset case in 1772, a slave. So we go from one extreme to the other.
Here.
So it's not just freemen alone, and it's not just royalty and nobility, but it can be even a slave, the rights of a slave, that these become major, major milestones, as Madison wrote, the great rights of mankind.
Did colonial judiciaries then differ, colonial in what would become the United States, differ from those back in England? Were there significant differences?
Yes, some major ones. What happened in England is there's a gradual evolutionary change to more and more independence of the judiciary, so that at first the judges were appointed at the pleasure of the king. and they served at the pleasure of the king. So if they made a bad decision, not a bad decision,
well,
if they made
lie.
One against the king, they were removed, and they would be lucky if they weren't in jail. But Chief Justice Cook, one way that he was removed was he was elevated to Parliament. And you can't serve in Parliament if you're a judge. And so that was one of the way they got rid of him.
Kicked upstairs.
And when he caused trouble in Parliament, they made him a sheriff. And so you couldn't serve if you were a sheriff. But in the Act of Settlement, 1701, the judges were given good behavior as their term. First time in English history that it was specified that the judges had that. Previously, however, from Old England, the judges used to all have to give up their commissions when the king died. Whatever king gave them an appointment, when that king died, they gave up their commission, and they hoped to be reappointed by the next king. And so that was changed, that the judges kept their commissions despite the intervening death of a king. That's not true in America. In America, we didn't have either one, good behavior or the stability of a judge after a king died. When a king died, all American judges lost their commissions. Americans petitioned for those changes but never got them under the crown. And so they were aware of those shortcomings in the independence of the judiciary, their own judiciary, when the English judiciary had those protections.
One of the cases that you talked to us about back in the past on University of the Air from colonial America was the Zenger case. How does that fit in with the development of the judiciary?
The Zenger case is known by most people as the protection of freedom of the press. But it began really as protection for the independent judiciary because the new governor of New York, William Cosby, not a very good politician, he wanted to retrieve half of his salary that the chief counsel member took when Cosby was still in England. He stayed in England about a year and a half after his appointment. And so when he came to America, he wanted to retrieve half of his salary. And the chief counselor said no. And so what William Cosby wanted to do was to use the colonial Supreme Court as a court of equity. He knew he couldn't get a jury of New Yorkers to agree with him. So he wanted to take his case in a court of equity. And that had never been done before in New York, a court of equity as called by the governor. It had been a court of equity as called by the legislature, but not by the governor. And so when the court refused to do this, the Chief Justice was thrown off off the court, was dismissed. And so that's what the case was all about. And you get the establishment of a new newspaper that supports Lewis Morris, was the Chief Justice, supports his point of view. And so what the jury eventually decides in that case is that despite the fact that the attorney for the defendant, Zenger, admits that his client did publish this libelous material and admits that it was aimed at the governor, and that's all the jury was supposed to say. This was two partial verdicts. And then the judges, the two remaining judges on the court, would take those partial verdicts and apply the law. And obviously, Zenger would be found guilty. But what the jury did instead was to come up with a general acquittal. Now, what makes that so important is that all other governors in all the colonies, that was 1735. Now, if we look at 1735 to 1776, that's 41 years. In that 41-year period of time, there was only one arrest on libel, seditious libel. And there was a lot of seditious libel going on. We have a revolution that's taking place here. And yet only one time in New York, Alexander McDougall was arrested, and he was not brought to trial. The reason that was is that the colonial governors understood the Zenger case made it clear that you could not get a conviction for criticizing the government. So that's what made the Zenger trial so important. And it made the American Revolution possible. It's not at all surprising that from 1735, when that case was decided, until 1776, the most popular pamphlet published in America was the Zenger trial and its proceedings. And it was only superseded by Thomas Paine's Common Sense. And so it was sort of a primer for how do you run a revolution? without getting arrested?
Yes. Well, when it comes to setting up a judiciary, you have, in addition to English common law and tradition, by the time you get to the 1780s, you have what would become the state constitutions. You also have the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation is, I guess, usually remembered as being a constitution that just wasn't quite adequate. What did it have to say about a judiciary?
It had one court, and that was a court, an appellate court, for captures and prizes. And it had a lot of difficulty getting its decisions when it overturned a court of original jurisdiction in the states. When it overturned any of those, had a hard time getting that decision, their decision, operated upon. The state legislatures, the state executives, didn't accept the decisions of the appellate court under the Articles of Confederation. And that's true also of a semi-judicial court that they had. It was a commission that was set up to settle all disputes between and among states over land. And it was a very complicated procedure. One whole article of the 13 Articles of Confederation dealt with this particular issue. And so the two contending states would submit their positions in Congress, and then every state would appoint three judges, in essence, three commissioners. And then the two contending states would start taking off each of these commissioners until they got down to 13 of them. And then they heard the case. And so the case in question was a dispute between Connecticut and Pennsylvania. Connecticut settlers moved to Pennsylvania, the northeastern Pennsylvania, the Wyoming Valley, and they said they owe their allegiance to Connecticut. The Pennsylvania Assembly said, no, you owe allegiance to us. And so this was to be decided by this commission. And the commission gave its decree in Trenton. It's known as the Trenton Decree, 1783, December of 83. And it said Pennsylvania was right, that the land belongs to Pennsylvania, whereupon the Connecticut settlers declared their independence and set up their own government under Connecticut, whereupon the Pennsylvanians called out the militia and civil war occurred. And so you see here that it didn't work because the Confederation Congress didn't have the power to implement it. And so the very next year, 1784, when Massachusetts delegates in Congress come up with a new interpretation of their colonial charter, saying, we Massachusetts own all of Western New York. The New Yorkers said, no, you don't. They couldn't get a commission together to settle this disagreement. And finally, the two sides sent agents to Hartford, where they compromised. And in fact, you'd be surprised that what the compromise was Massachusetts got all of Western New York. They owned all of it, and they could sell it, and they did sell it for the profit they got for it. But all the land remained within the jurisdiction of New York. So here's a case where they saw there was real problems, land problems, and the judicial system wasn't sufficient to settle those problems.
Where did the Northwest Ordinance fit into the story?
The Northwest Ordinance was different than the Confederation government, per se, or the state governments, where the people had the right to elect their officials, including their judges, either directly or indirectly. But in this particular case, in the Northwest Ordinance, Congress appointed the governor, the secretary of state, and the three judges. Consequently, what was done to protect citizens in the Northwest Territory, which includes the five states north and west of the Ohio River, meaning Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin, people living there had a federal Bill of Rights, miniature as it was, but there was no federal Bill of Rights under the Articles of Confederation because the Confederation Congress could not act upon individuals, could only act upon states. But the governor and the legislature eventually and the courts in the Northwest Territory could act upon individuals. And so because of that, because of their appointment, there was a miniature Bill of Rights that was established to protect citizens so that there would not be their rights would not be jeopardized under this court that was appointed by Congress.
And we will look at how the judiciary evolved through the creation of the Constitution when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. Resolved that a national judiciary be established to consist of one or more supreme tribunals and of inferior tribunals to be chosen by the national legislature to hold their offices during good behavior and to receive punctually at stated times fixed compensation for their services, in which no increase or diminution shall be made so as to affect the persons actually in office at the time of such increase or diminution. That's from the Virginia Plan of May 29, 1787, as proposed for the Constitutional Convention of 1787 and the establishment of a judiciary for the United States of America. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest John Kaminsky, and we're looking at the founding of the American judiciary. As the states come together to hammer out a constitution and ultimately to ratify it, was there one state or two in particular that served as models for an American judiciary?
Yes. Certainly the delegates to the Constitutional Convention looked at the broader picture. They looked at English, their English heritage. They looked at their colonial experience. But every state formed a new constitution as the Revolution broke out. Connecticut and Rhode Island just altered a few words in their colonial charter, but then to serve as their constitution. But there were two states that stand out as being real models for the Constitutional Convention, and that was New York's Constitution and Massachusetts' Constitution. There were certain things in both of them that were liked and certain things that were disliked. And so, for instance, in New York's Constitution, judges had to retire at the age of 60. There was a term limit on that, an age limit. That was not accepted by the Constitutional Convention. But the procedure that called for the nomination and confirmation of the appointment of judges really followed the example in Massachusetts, and many other provisions of the Constitution come from the Massachusetts Constitution, which was drafted in 1779 by John Adams and then became operative in 1780. And so many people argue, wasn't it fortunate that Thomas Jefferson was in France and John Adams was in England at the time of the Constitutional Convention, because they would not have been cooperative and contributing delegates. I argue just the opposite. I think they would have been very, very helpful. Jefferson would have certainly favored a Bill of Rights, and there would have been a Bill of Rights there. And I say John Adams was there. He was there in spirit because the Massachusetts Constitution served as the basis, the foundation for the new federal Constitution.
What did James Madison think about the judiciary, and what kind of role did he play?
James Madison had one major failure in the Constitutional Convention when it came to the judiciary. He was successful in almost everything. Right away, they voted they're going to have good behavior for the tenure. Right away, they're going to have no salary changes. And Madison was strongly in favor of both of those. A little bit later on, there was a change in the salary. Some delegates, George Mason in particular, said inflation will take place and these judges will be around a long time, so their salaries should go up, not down ever. Madison didn't like that. Madison thought salaries should stay the same. And if a judge wanted a higher salary, he or she would have to give up the commission and get reappointed again.
That was not very forward-thinking, was it?
No. And so that obviously didn't happen. And so we do have a provision that allows for the increase in salary, but no decrease in salary. Madison was strenuous in favor of a inferior federal judiciary. When that first came up, it was voted down.
And what do you mean exactly by inferior federal?
Just a lower court.
Courts, yes. The Virginia Plan, which was the foundation upon which the convention debated the different issues, call for one or more Supreme Courts. We didn't know how many there might be. There might be one for each section of the country, but one or more and inferior courts. And what the convention ruled when they took up the idea of inferior courts was there would be no inferior courts, that the state courts would serve as the inferior federal courts. And so the state courts would rule on all federal laws. And if the Supreme Court wanted to consider any state ruling, it could. And it would then be decided finally in the federal Supreme Court. Well, this was a terrible decision in Madison's eyes. And so he immediately changes the motion, and James Wilson of Virginia goes along with him, seconds the motion. And the motion is that there could be an inferior court if Congress so decided. So and they voted in favor of doing that. So we went from there will be, there must be inferior courts to there could be inferior courts. Now, Madison also felt that there was danger from the states. And so he wanted Congress to have a veto power over all state laws, not just state laws that were in contravention of the federal constitution, but every single state law. The Congress should be able to look at that and decide whether it should stand or not, if it was a good law or a bad law.
Regardless of a challenge, you mean?
That's right.
Regardless of an application.
That's right. And so this was the way to protect the rights of citizens from overbearing state legislatures. And Madison couldn't get in and change the state constitutions to give the structural kind of checks and balances that he was trying to create at the federal level that would protect rights. So the way to protect rights was sort of had the big brother of the federal government deciding on the virtue of every law, and not just the virtue, did it comply with the federal constitution, but was it a good or was it a bad law? And so he was unsuccessful in doing that. But he also, that was one of the big failures he had. The other big failure that he had was he wanted to create what was called a council of revision. And this was based upon New York. It had a council of revision. And what this was in New York was that the governor and the chancellor, who was the chief equity judge, and the three justices of the Supreme Court, they served as sort of a third branch of the legislature. Every single bill that was passed by both houses of the legislature had to then go to the Council of Revision. And the judges, being the most important, there are four judges and one governor, they're going to look at every one of those bills and decide whether they'll give it its approval or not. And if they veto it, it goes back to the House and to the Senate, and they can override that veto by a two-thirds vote. This is debated heavily in the Constitutional Convention. And what they decide there is, no, under our written Constitution, the judiciary has the right of judicial review, that they will look at all federal laws and when they come up as cases. They should not be given a second opportunity. A first, it would be the first opportunity, as soon as the law is passed by Congress, to have the opportunity to look at it. They said the judges have no special expertise at setting policy as compared to people who were elected. And so Madison felt this would make the Congress much more responsible. And I think I deal with federal judges a lot today, and many of them say one of the problems they face is sloppy legislation, and that if the legislation was clearer, they wouldn't have to make so many decisions that they're criticized for. And so that's what Madison wanted, was to have a sort of a chilling impact upon Congress that they would do a better job in writing the legislation if they knew that the judges were waiting there in this council of revision to give sort of a declaratory judgment that this is a good law or a bad law. But that failed, and so that provision didn't get in the Constitution.
Was there any talk at this point, as they're working on the Constitution, about whether the judges should be elected? I mean, if you're going to have judges reviewing laws and deciding whether they're good or not, that's a lot of power. And, you know, if you've got the legislature that's elected, you've got the executive branch elected, what are some of the arguments for and against the election of judges?
It's not so much the election of judges. I think they pretty much were of the opinion that judges should not be elected. But there was a great deal of disagreement as to how they should be appointed. Who should be doing the appointing and who should be doing the confirming? And so you get the Congress should make the appointment. The Senate should make the appointment. The state judiciary, state Supreme Courts should make the appointment. The president should make the nomination. Strangely enough, At the very end of the Constitutional Convention, we had probably 80% of the Constitution written. And what we had was judges were to be nominated by the Senate and confirmed by the President. And all the other unfinished business went to a committee that was appropriately called the Committee on Unfinished Business. And they decided everything else. We don't know what happened in that committee. We know what went in and we know what came out. And what went in was the Senate appointment of judges and the presidential confirmation of judges. But what happened was the committee decided that the Senate should try impeachments of all federal office holders, including judges. And once they made that decision, they realized if they're going to try the impeachment trials, they shouldn't make the appointments because they would never get rid of somebody that they appointed. And so it switched around in that committee that the president got the nomination and the Senate got the confirmation. So that was something done very, very late in the convention. And so it was felt that there should be some kind of nomination process and that the people should not elect the judges. It's not until about the 1820s that you get the idea that maybe we need more democracy and judges should be elected. And one after another of the state constitutions are changed accordingly.
Up through the state level, but again, we're talking about the Supreme Court, it's
right.
Presidential nomination and congressional confirmation.
There are various judicial decisions that are made that give rise to proposed amendments as to how the judges might be elected as opposed to appointed and more amenable to the people. But none of those get accepted as amendments that are adopted.
As the debates take place over whether the Constitution should be ratified, how do the Federalists and Anti-Federalists sort of stake their position in regard to the judiciary?
The Anti-Federalists come out very strongly against this federal judiciary. And according to Brutus that Norman read in the beginning of the broadcast, they objected to the independence of the judiciary. It was just too independent. Never before was there a court that was completely independent as the American judiciary would be, the federal judiciary. In England, they were used to the law lords that could overrule decisions of any court. In America, you had a number of different courts, and you had in New Jersey, for instance, the Legislative Council would sit as the court of last resort. So it was a legislative body. In New York, the New York Constitution provided for a court of error and impeachment, which was made up of the deputy governor, not the governor, but the deputy governor, the Senate, which at that time had 30 members but could grow to 70, and the judges, the three Supreme Court justices and the chancellor. And so you can see at that time you have the deputy governor, the Senate, that's 30, that's 31, and four judges. So the legislators had the vast majority. And so the deputy governor was there because the deputy governor presided over the Senate. So you wanted a legislative override of the judiciary. So you had this in different state constitutions. But under the new United States Constitution, there was nothing superior to the judiciary if it would make its decision. And in fact, when we talk about judicial review, and this is a very controversial issue because there is no specific provision in the Constitution that provides judicial review. But in the debate in the Constitutional Convention, they talk about judicial review. Remember I mentioned that they didn't want to give judges two shots at a law in the Council of Revision and then later on in judicial review. Everyone accepted there would be judicial review. This was a new thing that was getting play in the states during the Articles of Confederation, and everyone accepted that judicial review would be there. And so this is controversial. If you give the judiciary that kind of power, who will be able to overturn bad decisions? There is no one that's specified here in the Constitution, so anti-federals are worried about that. They're worried about the lack of the vicinage. That is, courts used to be in the locality. And in fact, they wanted jurors to know the defendants and the witnesses intimately.
Somewhat
just the opposite
of today. Yes,
you have to have a jury that's ignorant of everybody involved in the case. They want to know if Norman was on trial, let's say, for theft. They want to know what kind of character did Norman have. From was he a little trickster his entire life? And the people would testify against him. How honest were they? They had to know that. And so that the proximity of the trial was very important. And under the Constitution, it says the trial will be held in the state. Well, that could be 500 miles away, as large as these states were. So that was a dangerous thing. There was no guarantee of a jury trial in civil cases. Well, civil cases can be very important. And in fact, in England, that was the way that kings often got rid of their opponents. They brought them into court. They didn't convict them. They just bled them white by taking away their money that they needed to defend themselves. And so they felt there should be a protection for a trial by jury in civil cases. The Federalists said, well, that's too difficult. The states have too many different points of view. Some states had jury trials for certain cases, admiralty cases, let's say, probate cases, cases involving family court. Other states did not. And so it was too hard to say, yes, we'll guarantee it. The sense was Congress will come up with a plan that will work. Well, anti-federalists, the opponents of the Constitution, don't like that kind of, relying upon whether Congress will do the right thing or not. There was a jury trial guaranteed in criminal cases, so they liked that. But the judiciary was – the appellate court was given jurisdiction in both law and fact. And so what that meant in the eyes of the anti-federalists was they could a criminal trial as well as a civil trial could be appealed to the higher court, and that higher court would not only look at the law, that the law was properly administered, but look at the facts again and determine something different than what the jury had done. And so was that a real protection of trial by jury in criminal cases? The anti-federalists said no. There was a sense that the federal judiciary was going to be very expensive and thus be an arm that the wealthy could use against their less well-to-do opponents. And the other thing was that it would be detrimental to the state judiciaries, that it would, as courts have always been doing in the English and American system, they grow incrementally. A little bit, a little bit, a little bit. They get more and more jurisdiction, more and more power, more and more salary perhaps. And so there was the fear that this federal judiciary would deplete the power of the state judiciaries.
What about provisions for removing judges at this point? Like, let's say you have a judge that's appointed and he goes insane.
In the Constitutional Convention, John Dickinson of Delaware proposes the power to remove judges by address. This was a provision put in the Act of Settlement that provided for term for good behavior. But the very next clause said that a judge could be removed by address. And what that means is that if a certain percentage of the legislature requests the king in England or the president or the governor, the executive officer, to remove a judge for whatever reason, insanity, alcoholism, bad decision-making, magisterially ruling from the bench, all these things that were not crimes. The impeachment was limited to bribery and high crimes and misdemeanors and treason. But what about these other kinds of cases? So what Dickinson said, let's have removal by address. And they debated that, and they said no, that the term of office for good behavior should protect judges and shouldn't allow judges to be removed without a trial. And so when it was voted on, it was 11 states to one. Only Connecticut voted in favor of removal by address. And it's interesting to see today, if you look at the Wisconsin state constitution under the judiciary, you would think that the first provision would be for the appointment of judges. But it's not. The first provision is for the removal of judges. And so they were more concerned in Wisconsin about removing a judge than the appointment of a judge. And it is removal by address. And we see today that there is a movement to remove one of our judges on the Supreme Court by address today, Justice Gableman, because of his problems that he's had. A state legislator is trying to have him removed by address.
We'll look further at the founding of the American judiciary when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
In 1774, our first patriots considered an independent judiciary as the most precious of our rights. In 1804, it has been represented as the most burdensome and degrading of our encumbrances. That's Fisher Ames to Dwight Foster in June of 1806, showing two ways of looking at the independent judiciary. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is John Kaminsky. We're talking about the founding of the American judiciary. So after all the debates over the Constitution, what do we end up with? Here we are. We're a new country. What do we have?
Well, they passed the Judiciary Act of 1789, which is the only important act of legislation that was drafted in the Senate. All the other important laws were drafted in the House of Representatives. But this law provides for the creation of a Supreme Court of six. A little unusual that it's not an odd number. And then there's a district judge in every single state, 13 of them, but also Maine and Kentucky, because they're fairly substantial districts in Massachusetts and in Virginia. They get a district judge as well. So there's 15 district judges. And then those two judges are those two levels of courts, the district judge for each state and the Supreme Court, are sort of married together in a circuit system. We don't have a separate appellate level in between. What we have is three separate circuits. The Northern Circuit goes from Maine through New York, the Middle from Pennsylvania to Virginia, and the Southern Circuit, the two Carolinas and Georgia. And within each of those circuits, two justices of the Supreme Court ride the circuit with one state district judge, and they meet several different places in the state. So it's a complicated and very onerous job for the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court meets twice a year, in February and in August. So justices of the Supreme Court, they're away from home 6 months out of the year. It's a tough, tough job, and many of them don't last very long. This is the system that is created. Eventually, it's whittled down to one Supreme Court justice riding the circuit with one district judge. And so this is the system that we have, and it stays there until 1801, when the lame duck Congress, after the defeat of John Adams, changes it and creates a whole new system of appellate courts. That is, 16 new courts are established, and they're all filled by John Adams with partisan Federalists, making Thomas Jefferson, the new president, very, very angry.
The midnight appointments.
Yes. Now, I would say the quotation that you read from Fisher Ames, 1774, we wanted an independent judiciary in 1774, independent of Parliament, independent of the king, independent of the governors, the royal governors, one that would protect the rights of the individuals. But what happened in the 1790s, according to the Jeffersonians, is that independent judiciary didn't remain independent. It became a partisan arm of the Federalist Party. And it ruled in favor of the Federalists. And that was particularly galling to Jeffersonians under the Alien and Sedition Laws, that those laws were never brought before the Supreme Court, never brought before any court as to their constitutionality. They were brought before the courts, the district courts, whenever somebody was tried, and they were tried and punished, maybe not prosecution, maybe persecution would be the better word, because everybody was convicted, and that would include newspaper printers, and even one congressman from Vermont was convicted. One person was convicted because he characterized a caricature of the government, saying that the president, his behind was too large. He was convicted of seditious libel and put in jail and fined. And so everyone that was convicted got the full measure of the punishment, the full fine and a full jail sentence. And so this was no longer something that Jefferson could look to as a, as he said, a bulwark in favor of liberty, protecting the rights of the individuals, but it was now a partisan to be very suspicious of and be wary of.
What's important to know about John Marshall and the role that he played as Chief Justice?
John Marshall was appointed Chief Justice by John Adams. The Chief Justice, Oliver Ellsworth, was serving abroad as an envoy to France, and he wrote back saying he was sick and he could not get back and he was going to resign. It was at that point that John Adams appointed John Jay to be a second tour of duty as Chief Justice. Jay said he didn't want the job. And so it was at that point that the Senate approached Secretary of State John Marshall and said, we want the justice on the Supreme Court with the most seniority to be the Chief Justice. And that meant it would have been William Patterson, who was, in essence, a crony, if you want to use that word, of Alexander Hamilton. And when John Marshall said, relayed this message to President Adams, he said, no way would I appoint William Patterson as Chief Justice. What about you, Mr. Marshall? Would you like to be Chief Justice? He had already turned down an Associate Justice position. He didn't want to be Associate Justice. But Marshall, in his diary, said, in his journal, he wrote, I bowed my head in silence. And so he was nominated as Chief Justice. He had already written a piece when he was elected to Congress. After he came back from France, he was elected to Congress, and then he was appointed Secretary of State and then Chief Justice. But when he was in Congress, he wrote an article saying he didn't like the sedition law. He wouldn't vote for its repeal, but it would die off, and he was happy when it would die off. So he didn't get the Senate to like him, and the Senate didn't want him to be Chief Justice. They wanted Patterson. And so when his nomination came before the Senate, it took 7 long, agonizing days to get him confirmed, which is lightning speed today.
That's right.
Seven days only. Yeah. But he was elected. And he was then involved in one of the most important cases because he continued to serve as Secretary of State because there was only a month and a half left in the term. And so Adams kept him as Chief Justice and Secretary of State. And as Secretary of State, he did not send out all of the appointments, those midnight appointments that Adams was making to the Judiciary Act of 1801 that created these 16 new courts, not just judges, but bailiffs and clerks and all justices of the peace. There were 44 justices of the peace for the District of Columbia alone. All these were Federalists, and Marshall has to send out the commissions. He failed to send out a number of them. He was so busy, and that gave rise to the famous case of Marbury versus Madison.
Give us a quick, I know we did a whole program on that some years ago, but give us a quick sort of gloss on that, the Marbury case.
Well, Marbury says the court should give him a writ of mandamus, which this writ says the president must act according to the Constitution, send out these commissions. They're important documents. And what Marshall rules is that the president has two kinds of powers, political power in which he can do whatever he wants and that the court can't get involved. And then there are ministerial powers in which the president must do his responsibilities and his subordinates must abide by the Constitution. And so what Marshall is saying is, let's have a peace treaty here between the judiciary and the executive. We won't get involved in your politics. You don't get involved in our politics. And then what Marshall says is he rules the Judiciary Act of 1789 unconstitutional in one part. And that's the part that says that the Supreme Court under original jurisdiction, has the power to issue a writ of mandamus. And so he says, no, under appellate jurisdiction, we'll have that power, but not under original jurisdiction. So Mr. Marbury and his three fellow justices of the peace would be justices of the peace. They have to start out in the district court. Well, they didn't do that. They didn't really want the job. But this gave Marshall a platform. And so what he does is he rules in favor of Jefferson. Jefferson wins the case. But he does say also, we have the power over the executive in ministerial cases of the Constitution. That got Jefferson very angry. And so what he did, he mounted a campaign against the federal judges. And the first judge was John Pickering of New Hampshire. He was alcoholic and insane and ruled magisterially from bench. Not good for a judge. And so he was impeached by the Jeffersonian House of Representatives and tried, and the Senate convicted him under high crimes and misdemeanors.
And removed him.
No, yes, removed him. The Federalist in New Hampshire said, Mr. President, if you give us a Federalist judge, we'll make Pickering resign. And Jefferson would not make that promise. And so he was removed. On the day he was removed, they impeached Supreme Court Associate Justice Samuel Chase on 8 different counts, mainly from being a magisterial from the bench. And so this was a very dangerous precedent. And John Marshall realized that his neck was on the block next. And so he wrote a letter to Chase saying, in essence,
here it is. This is John Marshall to Samuel Chase, January 1805. According to the ancient doctrine, a jury finding a verdict against the law of the case was liable to an attaint, and the amount of the present doctrine seems to be that a judge giving a legal opinion contrary to the opinion of the legislature is liable to impeachment. As for convenience and humanity, the old doctrine of attaint has yielded to the silent, moderate, but not less operative influence of new trials. I think the modern doctrine of impeachment should yield to an appellate jurisdiction in the legislature. A reversal of those legal opinions deemed unsound by the legislature would certainly better comport with the mildness of our character than a removal of the judge who has rendered them unknowing of his fault. Can you translate that a little bit, John?
Well, it's just an amazing statement. The man who is known as the Great Chief Justice, what he is saying is, in Old England, whenever a jury did not abide by the instructions of the judge, they were thrown into jail and fined. And if they didn't pay their fine, they would stay in jail. But the Bushell case of 1670, Judge Mansfield ruled that, no, you could not taint a juror. You could not imprison a juror. What we would have is a second trial. There's no protection for double jeopardy in England at this time. And so this was a way to protect jurors from high-handed judges who might put them in jail. So in the United States, what Marshall says, if a judge makes a decision that a legislator doesn't like, they turn around and they impeach you right away. This is a terrible thing. And he says, instead of doing that, let's give the right of appeal of any judicial case to the legislature, in essence, probably to the Senate, to create the law lords in America. This would have changed all of American history. This would have made the judiciary not supreme, not independent. It was exactly what many of those anti-federalists wanted, was a legislative body that was higher than the Supreme Court. Once Samuel Chase was acquitted, that letter disappeared, and that offer that John Marshall made was not going to be repeated, not going to be made again to anybody. And I think really what we need to give credit, I think, at this point to James Madison, Secretary of State under Jefferson, and Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin. I think they informed President Jefferson that this has gone too far, that we need an independent judiciary, and this is a temporary thing with these Federalist judges. We'll get over that. And so we want an independent judiciary. You weren't here during the Confederation period when an independent judiciary was necessary. We need that. So let's call off the war dogs here. And they let Chase off, was not convicted. And I think because of that, we can say that Madison and Gallatin were really instrumental in protecting the independence of our judiciary.
Our guest has been John Kaminsky, looking at the founding of the American judiciary. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll be with us for the next hour of University of the Year.